This is episode number 13. Death is very likely the single best invention of life. It's life's change agent. It clears out the old to make way for the new. Your time is limited, so don't waste it living someone else's life.
Welcome to the Innovateology podcast, where it is all about unleashing the creative side to find those brilliant, disruptive ideas to validate and build innovative solutions to solve life's problems.
And welcome back to Innovateology Podcast. This is your host, Mary, and I'm also joined today with Linda.
Hello.
And today we'll be talking about life and death. So, do innovations that extend life make life better? Would it be wonderful to find the secret to living forever? Some very smart people are actually working on it right now. So most of us strive to live a healthy and productive life. We spend lots of money on health. The industries that cater to health are valued at billions and billions of dollars. So what does that mean to live well? Or does it mean that we will live forever or both? Some questions to answer today are, what motivates us to spend more money on health? Why do we die? And what would it be wonderful to live forever? So with that, I have Linda on the line, and we're going to just jump right into this first question. So what effect does environment have on life?
Hi, Mary. Yeah, I think that speaking about environment is probably the best place to begin in a discussion about life and death and why we have finite lifespans. Because really, science has proven that human life really came to exist on this planet because the stew that's the environment around us evolved to support it. So the single cell life forms that first came to be really continue to evolve and differentiate into the human species and other creatures that are living and being on this planet. So you could really say that Earth truly is the parent of the human species. It's kind of fun to think that, you know, we often refer to the planet with a gender reference, like Mother Earth. But we are so often seeing the world through the frame of just our own existence. So even this gender reference is a reference to our own process of evolution, which is sexual reproduction. But actually, interestingly, not all species really require two to reproduce. So, you know, because our lifespans are relatively brief, the persistent change around us in the environment is mostly imperceptible. However, if we consider how fascinated we are with the pace of technological advances, when we just think through our own lifetimes, how much has changed in how we live due to technology, then we could consider that as a sort of analog to appreciate that as rapid and significant as we think those changes are, that actually much more subtle but much grander changes are happening in our environment and influencing really the evolution of the human species as we know it. So we just can't appreciate the changes due to the shortness of our lives on Earth.
So that's very, very interesting, kind of this first point. But then let's get into the next point of what motivates us to spend so much money on health.
Yeah, well, for quite a while, and I'd say even up to today, that a lot of money is spent in a reactive way. For instance, according to the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, the U.S. federal government, which is the single largest payer of healthcare dollars in the U.S., spent more than $3 trillion on healthcare in 2016. It's really a number that's difficult for most of us to grasp. So to put it in possibly better terms, it would really equate to spending roughly $10,000 a year on every U.S. citizen. And again, that's just what the government pays. Government insurers and government payers, I should say, and the insurers we know, you know, for quite a while, they've been paying most of the healthcare dollars. And as I said, it's often in a reactive way to treat health problems, to eliminate or alleviate unpleasant symptoms, and sometimes to slow disease progression. But we haven't really been very proactive, or at least the third-party payers that we have haven't largely been able to advocate proactive spending on health, that is, preventative spending. Scientific advances in recent decades, though, have extended life significantly. And an author I like, Yuval Noah Harari, in his book Sapiens, actually speaks about a smart technology groups of people who are working to eliminate death. So this is really fun to kind of tease with in your head, because the notion of, on one level, the elimination of death seems like it might be awesome, because we'd always have all our loved ones around us and it would be great. But would it really be wonderful to live forever? And in addition to government and insurer spending on healthcare, we individuals choose to spend directly on our health too. And we buy healthy foods, we join fitness centers, we buy fitness clothes. Sometimes I have to laugh because I look at some of the clothes I've bought and think, by osmosis, I guess, I think wearing them will make me more fit. No, I also have to go to the gym. But then we also buy fitness meals and we listen to fitness gurus. So we individuals tend to try to be proactive oftentimes in our health. But is our goal just to live healthy, or subtly do we think, well, maybe we'll be the ones that continue to live forever? Much of our motivation, though, to open our wallets is really improving the immediate. So improving our level of fitness and energy in the near term, really, lessening that stress that we have right now with work or home life, and enhancing our appearance and attractiveness. Perhaps we've met somebody interesting, or we just are involved in groups where we present or do business and we want our appearance to be at our best. And so that results in our commitment to our own fitness often waxing and waning. And I think the best evidence of how our kind of level of commitment to health and being proactive about it changes is really the fact that the greatest number of fitness center enrollments always happens at the start of every new year. So as we often begin New Year's, we begin to think about all of the fun, perhaps, and all the food we've had during the last few months with the holidays. And then we commit to kind of hunkering down and getting healthy again every new year.
So I call that the State of the Union. So it's our personal State of the Union, just like the president does every year.
Yeah.
Where we look and we say what was working, what wasn't working. We may have our own political agenda in there. But definitely, I think the fitness clubs get a boost of revenue that first month. But then I always saw this in the swimming pool. And this was always, I never went to the pool in January during certain times, just because I saw everybody in there for that first month, you know, thinking I'm going to swim 100 laps or, you know, get this great goal in. And then all of a sudden by February, they'd be out of the pool doing something else. So yeah. I was like, I'll restock my membership in February. So it's always an interesting concept right there.
It is.
And I also like the fact that you brought up the couple of different points, and I just want to go into a couple of them. So life is sometimes what we call priceless. We hear the commercial all the time from like Visa has this great commercial where they say, you know, what's the cost of that? Priceless.
Yes.
So with death, it's almost like, what is that cost that you want to put towards life? How much are you willing to spend towards it? And that goes to that whole proactive business of keeping healthy, keeping fit, and kind of living that mantra. And I too am a fitness clothes junkie. I think half my wardrobe is fitness clothes. And when I'm not in the office, I wish I could wear fitness clothes all day long. That's another story about how can you actually wear fitness clothes in the office? Is there a way we can actually turn that fun fabric into a business wear. So those are all really interesting points, from proactive to, you know, how do you put a price on life? And where should we be spending our money? Should we be spending our money fighting that to keep that one last day, or should we be spending it towards that proactive? And I think this is always a dilemma that we always face, is how much money should you spend at Whole Foods? Obviously, I call it Whole Paycheck, but there's many reasons on what, where you should be spending your money, and how do you allocate that? So very interesting points.
Yeah. And actually, Mary, another key point is that, you know, as I mentioned, the scientific advances we've had really extended life significantly. You know, almost increasing it by a third versus just how long the average grandparent lived. But there's a lot of discussion now about where's the quality of life in that life extension. So it's really an interesting time we're living in.
All right, so let's get into another question. And the next question is why do we die?
Yeah, well, what's funny is that, you know, I never even thought about it, because it's such a part of, you know, what happens. We see, you know, nature kind of live through death every fall. And we see various people and family and so on pass away. And so I just thought, oh, that's life, really. But then in some of the books I've been reading, including Sapiens by Harari, and even in this book, Dr. Andrew Weil has written, called Healthy Aging, they actually both raise the question of, you know, why do we die and the value of it. And there's this question was also posed on Quora, which is a knowledge sharing network, and where experts reply to these, you know, really compelling questions of our time. So I thought it was interesting that one expert in Quora responded to the question of why do we die? And her name is Dr. Suzanne Sededen. She's an evolutionary biologist. Now, she began her response by first talking to some common myths, which she said it's a myth that we die to make room for the next generation, which is often what people say. And she also said it's a myth that we die because our cells get damaged with age. Dr. Sededen said that we make the mistake of thinking that evolution is our friend. And in reality, she said, our genes are our friends, or I should say our genes should be our friends. Now, this may sound funny since we're made of genes, but Dr. Sededen said the genes don't really care about you and me, so to speak. They're kind of agnostic, parts of our being, and they are real innovators. So they're motivated to succeed, even if it means our death. And that seems like a contradiction, right? Because when the genes go away, if we go away. There are, in fact, many examples of health conditions that are actually the result of genetic changes. And genetic changes are often referred to as mutations. And the genetic mutations are really the way genes survive. It's their survival strategies. And basically, you know, just as we enjoy variations on a theme in music, really what happens in a big way through our genes and over time is a lot of this variation. They're the great creators and innovators. And so they're constantly in, you know, imperceptible ways changing and adapting to the environment. So there are mutations, for instance, that can cause the death of parents, but they allow the parents to live long enough to reproduce. This can be a real huge factor with influencing the gene's evolution is the environment. So the genes respond to the environment. They enable parents to reproduce. And then because of the environment, the genes then may be expressed in a way that then causes the death of the parents. But the important point is that the genes were able to continue through the offspring. You might be tempted to say that this idea of, you know, continuing through offspring really supports the make room theory. But the evolutionary biologists argue that genes are really smart and they would really prefer staying with a parent. It's kind of like when we talk about customer acquisition. It's better you spend a lot less energy and time if you keep your current customers. You spend more money and energy on prospective customers. So the genes, you can think about the same way. Genes are happy when 100% of them are with the parent, rather than just half of them going to offspring. But the sexual reproduction that we have evolved just because in response to our environment, there's so many threats to the parent that the genes found a way to be, successfully continue through, through sexual reproduction in many beings. So a reality is that we exist in an environment that changes. And so genes change in response to that environment. You know, when you think about it, we have lots of risks every single day in our life. So the genes try to make the most of it, or they make hay while they can. On any given day, we could die due to a flood or a tornado or a fire or falling off a cliff or being killed by an adversary. So the genes learned this efficient way to continue by having sexual reproduction evolve in many beings. So it's really, you know, a fascinating thing to consider that even the fact that we do have a finite lifespan is part of this sort of design so that the human species would continue. What's fascinating is that in our own lifetimes, or at least those who are as old as I am, we've lived through the decoding of the human genome. And right now we're in this really baby stage of learning all about genes and how genes affect us. So I thought it was totally fascinating, again, referring to Harari's book, Sapiens, where he referred to this group of folks in Silicon Valley who are actually really working in a committed way to eliminating a death altogether. But this question comes up about, you know, why we die in Dr. Andrew Weil's book, Healthy Aging, where Weil takes a different point of view from, you know, from the folks who are trying to eliminate death. He really urges us to accept aging. He provides guidance to support living well as we age through nutrition and appropriate exercise, etc. But he takes an interesting point of view because he said we really age best when we learn to reap the insights that aging offers. And Weil doesn't actually advocate eternal youth. Instead, he really alludes to a spiritual dimension to being. And it's this interesting other dimension where individuals' true essence really remains, even though the body itself dies or ceases to exist. So Weil and many others like him really say that there is a lot of value to the way our life persists and even ends. And I think possibly a great example of a person who saw that value would be Steve Jobs. Because despite his genius and wealth, Steve Jobs died relatively young at 56 years of age. But he said, death is a destination we all share, even though no one really wants to die, not even the people who believe in heaven. But Jobs said that death is probably the single best invention of life. Jobs said that death is life's change agent. And he continued to say it clears out the old and makes way for the new. And he felt that really the idea of having a limited life is something that's motivational for us, and Jobs, encouraged that, your time is limited, so don't waste it living someone else's life. Really, it was motivational to take it on and live your best life while you have it.
So there's some interesting points here. And one of it is, I almost think of Steve Jobs as how many times he transitioned in life,
mm-hmm.
right? So I'm going to actually phrase this and say, why do we die in a company?
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Right? So
mm-hmm.
we're looking at this from, I know companies like to use evolution as a keyword
mm-hmm.
for essentially, we're going to terminate Jobs. We're going to actually evolve this company. And that's a keyword for, we're going to let some people go.
Mm-hmm.
So why is it that certain people survive within a company, and why are certain people let go? So it's, it's almost this evolving this theme, right? And I know that, Linda, you interviewed quite a few people in their job transformation.
Mm-hmm.
And what can we learn from that and really evolve? And why do some survive?
Yeah, well, actually, that's a great point, Mary. And I think it's actually fascinating that that terminology has kind of moved into the business world. But what we're seeing is evolutions of lots of industries. We've seen it in the auto industry, in the media industry, and in the, if I could take a case of, pharmaceutical industry really evolved to be much more a biologic industry. And, the transition term is biopharmaceuticals. But, what technology brings to the corporate and will continue to is it will really say we need less humans to execute. And with less people needed to produce some of these things. For instance, biologics require far less people to for production than pharmaceuticals did. That then we need different sorts of folks who actually handle the technologies of these new environments. So while there's many fewer people who are needed in highly technical manufacturing situations, such as biologics, you need people who are educated and trained at a much more sophisticated level to work and manage those environments. And that extends to every aspect of business then, because you really are looking for new skill sets. And for people who kind of see trends and adapt to trends, and I guess I'll highlight the adapt word, because the people who survive, whether it's just life itself or work life, the key word is adapting, monitoring trends and following those trends and making sure you're continuously improving and educating yourself to be in sync with the realities of the world you're living in. So to go back to your question, from all the people that I talk to, including those who hire and those that were seeking and successfully were retained in companies, it's really the people who are able to adapt to what the changing business needs are. So I think there's been some very smart people who've done a lot of research about survival. And what they found over and over again is it's not necessarily the people with the highest IQ or the people that are, the best looking and all of that. The people that really can persist successfully are those with the skill at adaptation.
So I can only imagine seeing someone actually like change colors, just like some of those lizards do.
That's great.
So it's like when you walk into a new environment, you change color, whatever the logo is, you change to that logo, but had that culture. So that's kind of what I think of when I think of, you're not terminating your job per se, you're just changing your color a little
mm-hmm.
bit.
Absolutely.
You're adapting to that environment.
Mm-hmm.
So instead of being that polar white bunny, you might be that brown bunny that's hiding in the desert.
Yeah.
Very interesting there. So I'm going to jump right into this next question. So would it be wonderful to live life forever?
Yeah, because at first blush, I think all of us might say, or many of us would say, yes. But then consider the implications of suddenly living in a world where no one died except, you know, when accidents or natural disasters happened. You know, think about our institutions and our whole lexicon that's really, our frame of reference for the world often is framed connected to these finite lifespans. So how would religions explain it if people just endlessly lived on Earth? And how would family units adapt? If you have the extended family, which is usually, the children, the parents and grandparents in a home, well, what if you had great and great, great and great, great grandparents? How would units function? And then how would people and governments afford it? Because certainly, even if you lived forever, there's still going to be things you'll, have organs that perhaps need to be replaced. We'll probably, I know that there's people that are looking at organ farms, so to speak. But still, you'd have to be able to afford these things. And how would the people who live forever work? How would the educational system and really all of our institutions change in response? And then you wonder, as Steve Jobs alluded to, he saw there was a real great purpose because he saw his contribution was in a finite time, and it was a huge contribution, and he felt it was appropriate that a next generation come in to continue the pace of innovation. So would, if we lived forever, would innovation continue or might it slow? And then if death became a rare event, imagine the psychological jolt that a single death might bring. And then, of course, how would our genes adapt? Because, as I shared, death really is a way of, we survive to, some reproduction. Our genes, pass along through reproduction. But if we actually lived forever, what would that mean? Because we would have genes that, somehow would have to evolve to accommodate, existence that would be such an extended, time. And you wonder, would our reproductive years be extended or shortened? Or what might we become asexual, much like some life forms on Earth? Since the dawn of humanity, the human lifespan really has increased significantly. And I find it amazing to consider that just as recently as the 1940s, okay, it's not that recent for many people, but for me, that the lifespan of my grandparents, which, people of that time would lived about to their 50s, and now we see people living in easily into their 80s and remaining very active. And more people are living into their 90s and beyond. However, for those of us who care for somebody who's elderly, there is the big question about enabling long life. Is it good if we don't also make sure that it comes with sustained quality of life? So I would argue that we have been really successful as a species with extending life, but we haven't really enabled the sustained quality of life as well as we might have. During the last year, I actually have had a lot of conversations about death, and I'm not a morbid person, but it's just come up quite a bit because more and more of my peers are caring for elderly parents. And interestingly, with the vast majority of people I've spoken with, and perhaps because they're caring for elderly people, where life extension has happened but not kept pace with quality of life, most people I have talked to said that they'd actually prefer fewer days, months, and even years of life in favor of life quality. Now, even if we cease to age physically, let's say we continue to live forever and we were at our 30-year-old best, you wonder if life would have the same richness if we didn't envision it coming to a close at some point? Or could it possibly be like this friend of mine who he moved to the West Coast and I chat with him, you know, probably every other month or so. And after a couple of years, he remarked to me that he actually found the everyday predictable weather was boring. And he really found that this, despite the fact that most of us on the East Coast feel, wow, it would be fabulous to have, you know, 70 degree sunny days every day. But for him, this lack of change was boring. And so you wonder if we did live forever, what would keep us stimulated and motivated and continuing to have high energy in our lives forward. So what I've concluded around this is really that perhaps whether we live a few days or a million more days, thanks to technology, maybe it really doesn't matter. Perhaps what really matters is that we focus on living fully now and enjoy the moment we have, however long it lasts.
Very interesting, Linda. So I have two points to make. Is living life truly a better? Because sometimes we need a little fire underneath us to basically leave that legacy, right? Mm-hmm. So every day I think about what that legacy means that I'm going to be leaving behind. And would I get too complacent if I knew that I was going to be immortal? And we look at some of the figures, I think, in Greek mythology and Roman mythology that were immortal, like Zeus. Mm-hmm. And they could basically destroy things. They could create things. Wouldn't life get boring?
Yeah.
If that was all that you saw.
And it's so much, actually, Greek mythology is a great example. And there's so many examples, actually, of stories of the, you know, fountain of youth. And so many great thinkers have explored this concept. And generally, they come to this conclusion that, you know, what seems like it could be really fascinating is actually comes to devastating ends. So we haven't been able to kind of come to a place where we can think about that concept of living forever in a way that actually could be, you know, productive and motivating and actually good for the human species.
Very, very interesting on all the points that you just made. And, you know, to sum it up, I think, you know, this is a great question. And no matter what we do in life, we should always enjoy the moment, no matter how long it lasts. And I think this comes back to, like, being mindful in that moment in time.
Yes.
And even though we may be planning out and maybe thinking about the future all day long in our work environments, being able to just enjoy that moment. Even with two screaming kids, I sometimes have to take a deep breath and be mindful about that moment and just say, you know what, it will pass, and you'll look back and you'll say, oh, that wasn't so bad. And so I think, you know, this was a great podcast, a great episode, and just kind of saying, hey, let's explore a different side. And what does it really mean? How does it impact life, and how can we live that legacy?
Yes, and to consider that there's innovation all around us, even when it comes to, you know, big questions like the life length that we have, and whether we even really need to die. So it's interesting to see that innovation and the you know, progression of thinking around innovation touches every aspect of the world around us.
Excellent. Well, thanks so much for everybody who's listening today. And we will definitely keep this as a hot topic as we explore many facets of innovatology. Well, that brings us to the end of this episode. Thanks for listening to the Innovatology Podcast. We hope we have generated some disruptive ideas and helped unleash that creative side. Please help us keep innovating and leave us a comment or a review on our website. Till next time, don't stop innovating.